Welcome to all of you to today's Ethics at Noon. It is my great pleasure to introduce Rich Benjamin, author of Searching for Whitopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of America. Rich is a senior fellow at DEMOS, a nonpartisan, multi-issue think tank in New York City. He received his BA in political science from Wesleyan University and his PhD in modern thought and literature from Stanford. He has served as senior editor of the Race Relations Reporter and as senior advisor to Why Tuesday, a bipartisan grassroots campaign to increase civic participation. He serves on the advisory boards of Realizing the Dream and the Roosevelt Institution, and is a member of the Authors Guild and the National Book Critics Circle. His social and political commentaries have been featured in nationwide newspapers and blogs, including The Huffington Post, Salon.com, and The Daily Beast. The event today is co-sponsored by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, the Santa Clara University Office for Multicultural Learning, Office of the Provost, and the Mark Ellis Center for Applied Ethics. I am very grateful for the collaboration of Kara Awahashi and the entire Commonwealth Club and Mary Ho of the Office for Multicultural Learning for their assistance and collaboration for today's event. And I'd like to extend a special welcome to all the members of the Commonwealth Club who are here with us today. Please note that the Commonwealth Club podcasts and broadcasts a number of its programs on KQED FM 88.5 on Fridays at 8 and KLIV AM 1590 on Thursdays at 7 p.m. In fact, the event today is being recorded for podcast to be available later on the websites of the Commonwealth Club and the Mark Ellis Center for Applied Ethics. Also, Mr. Benjamin's book is being sold, will be sold outside this room at the conclusion of this event at 1 o'clock. Invite you to buy a copy and actually, I think, get a signed copy, no less, here today. After his presentation, Mr. Benjamin will also take questions from all of you, so I invite you in advance to make your questions or comments brief and to the point. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Rich Benjamin.
Thank you, David, for that introduction. Can you hear me in the back? Good. And I want to thank the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley and Santa Clara University also for hosting this event. It means a lot to me to return to Silicon Valley. I spent some very memorable years, and I see a familiar face in the audience, Penelope Duckworth, who I met and knew while I lived in the Silicon Valley. And so speeding here at 90 miles an hour on Highway 280, I remembered why I love this area so much, among many things, the sense of possibility and the sense of joy and freedom. I want to focus my talks today on California. I've written a book called Searching for Whitopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America, and California seems to haunt this book like a ghost, and I'll explain why. Here we have two magazine covers that are very recent. The one to your left is The American Prospect, and it says, Is California Dreaming? And by pure happenstance, they've excerpted the book. And in the upper left-hand corner where you see the new white flight, you see an excerpt of Searching for Whitopia. To your right, you see this issue of Time magazine that says Why California is Still America's Future. Now, I'm out of sincere curiosity, I want to know, just a show of hands, how many of you are native-born Californians? Okay, that's fascinating. Okay, so everyone who's raised their hand was born in this great state. And I show you these magazine images because California has a dual image, as you well know, in the American mind. One image is apocalyptic, the other image is romantic and future-driven. Let me speak a little bit first about the apocalyptic image. here, and I will quote from the book later in the talk. There's a sense that California, because of budget deficits, because of overpopulation, because of natural disasters, and because of its racial diversity, is going to hell in a handbasket. And there are very many people who believe that nationwide. That's the apocalyptic notion of California. The visionary, optimistic notion of California has always been with us. California is a sense of manifest destiny. We saw this with when the gold prospectors moved here in the mid-19th century. We saw this again when entrepreneurs with a bunch of pluck moved to the orange groves in Southern California and invented America's dream factory and would later call it Hollywood. We saw this again when immigrants and native-born Americans came to Silicon Valley right among us and then spawned the digital revolution. So it's animating very much this book, this apocalyptic notion of California and this visionary optimistic notion of California. And as far as the visionary notion is concerned, to this very day, when I tell friends in New York City, I'm off to California, I'm off to California, I'm off to California, there's a romantic sense to that statement. So, searching for Whitetopia. Between 2007 and 2009, I embarked on a 27,000-mile journey to the fastest-growing, whitest communities in our country. I had been hearing on-the-ground buzz that white Americans, many of relatives of folks I know, moving to places like Bend, Oregon, Coeur d'Alene, Utah, St. George, Utah, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Now, another show of hands, does anybody know people who've moved recently to communities like this in the last decade? Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, St. George, Utah, Bend, Oregon. Okay, it's a pretty familiar phenomenon. And me too, I've known folks who've made that move, or at least in-laws of friends. So I decided to figure out what's going on with this trend. What's going on with this migration of white people to extremely white communities? And I call these communities Whitetopia. To my thinking, Whitetopia has three traits. The first is that it has posted more than 6% population growth since the year 2000. The second is the majority of that growth has come from white migrants. And the third trait of a Whitetopia is harder to define. It has a special charm, a pleasant look and feel, a je ne sais quoi. So three traits of Whitetopia. So what the book does in the back is I literally list every town and county in America that qualifies as a Whitetopia. But what I did is I took three sample Whitetopias and I embedded myself in these communities for 3 to 4 months of pop. The first community I immersed myself in was St. George, Utah. The second was Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And the third was Forsyth County, Georgia. And I'd just like to walk you through those communities and what my experiences there was like, beginning with St. George, Utah. St. George, Utah is a beautiful community. If you imagine the rich red canyon walls of the Grand Canyon, you can imagine what geographically St. George, Utah looks like. I rented a home during my 4 month stay there at the Entrada, which is the most prestigious gated community in St. George, Utah. And there's a lot of socializing in this book. In order to understand communities, to understand the spirit or essence of a place, I did a lot of socializing. I hosted a lot of dinner parties. I had a lot of people over to my house for dinner. People had me over for dinner. They'd send me home with a doggy bag full of pork chops and banana nut bread. I did a lot of golfing. I did a lot of hunting. I did a lot of fishing. I went to my first demolition derby. The only social invitation I declined ever in my 2 years in Whitetopia was when Derek and Lisa invited me to go rodeoing and calf tying and broncoing because they have 6 and 8 year old daughters, and I was terrified that 6 and 8 year old girls would out rodeo me. So I didn't take that invitation. But beyond the fun and the socializing was work to be done. And the way I did that work was to attend political meetings, to attend the meetings of local community groups and to see what was going on. For example, I'd go to commission meetings. I'd go to the Republican Party meetings. I'd go to, in St. George, Utah, there's a group called the Citizens Council Against Illegal Immigration, and I tagged the founder of that group and got to know her a bit. So the theme that emerges from the St. George, Utah visit is illegal immigration. And during the meeting of the St. George Citizens Council for Illegal Immigration, they would say, raise your hand, people. How many of you have lived in Tucson or Phoenix or L.A.? If you haven't lived in those communities, you don't know what we're in for here in St. George, Utah, unless we put a firewall against illegal immigration. So I'll read a quick excerpt. And this is me in the home of one of the founders of this group, and she's explaining her youth in California, and Carol Pines, an 83-year-old. Quote, "The California of my childhood was a little paradise," says 83-year-old Whitetopia resident Carol Pines. "When I went to Berkeley High and my husband Bob to Washington High in San Francisco, California had the best public school system in the country," she says fondly. "You know where it is now?" "No," I say. 47, right above Mississippi. Mrs. Pines maintains that illegal immigrant women purposefully have anchor babies to gain a toehold in America, then gain the system. "If we grant illegal aliens amnesty," she warns, "they will grab a political foothold and then vote. They will vote with their hand out." Here she thrusts out her hand like a panhandler, "and you and I, Rich, will pay the bill. Look at Southern California. Villa Guerrosa, Mecca, and La Raza have a stranglehold on California." She adds, "What's happening in L.A. is the native-born population is being driven out. In effect, 699,000 left last year, but they were replaced by many of these out-of-country immigrants." So in that chapter, there's this in-depth profile of this particular woman and her group, the Citizens Council Against Illegal Immigration. And I also attended Utah Minutemen meeting to hear what they had to say. So that's St. George, Utah. I spent 4 months there. And then I was off to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Coeur d'Alene, Idaho is its different beast. It's got beautiful lakes, namely Lake Coeur d'Alene, Hayden Lake, Lake Pend'Oreille. I happen to live on Hayden Lake. I rented a cabin for 4 months on Hayden Lake, and surprise, surprise, the cabin was owned by Californian transplants. And right above the deck leading to that gorgeous view was a little sign called Almost Heaven. And so chapter 4 is called Almost Heaven. And in case you don't know, Patricia Schultz wrote a book called 1,000 Places to See Before You Die. And Coeur d'Alene, Idaho is one of those places. So again, Coeur d'Alene, it's a lot of socializing. And what I did in Coeur d'Alene was to regularly attend the weekly 7A meeting of the Conservative Republican Forum to get a sense of what they're thinking and why they're in Coeur d'Alene. That area, i.e. North Idaho, its claim to fame is that there are a lot of retired LAPD cops, the most famous being Mark Furman of LAPD OJ fame, who retired to Sandpoint, Idaho in 1994. Now, after the LA riots and after some of the natural disasters in the early 1990s in Southern California, there was this flight of white LAPD officers, and now they have an expatriate community in North Idaho, and they go to bowling tournaments, they go to they have potluck suppers, and they have golf tournaments to fundraise for their brethren who are injured. So there is a big community of retired law enforcement and retired military personnel in North Idaho. Now, during this visit, and I won't go into it, it's written about in the book, I decided to visit Christian Identity Church, America's Promise, and their compound. America's Promise is the religious arm of Aryan Nations, and they have a stake in northern Idaho. And so I just wanted to see what it's like. And so I crashed their retreat for 3 days just to see what it's like. And the reason I did that is because there's this whole history of scholars going to inner cities and going to the ghetto or not going to the ghetto and writing about it without having interviewed the residents. So I didn't want to talk about white separatists without actually talking to white separatists. And so I have to confess, it's in the book, it's written, the funniest conversation I heard during that whole three-day Gab Fest, and there were political sermons, there was schmoozing, there were luncheons, there were dinners, there was hymns. As I said, it's the Christian arm of Aryan Nations, and it's the who's who gathering of white separatists nationwide. But the funniest conversation I heard was during one coffee break, Bill and Mark, two white separatists, were talking, and Bill was furious. He was saying, that David Duke, he's full of it. You know, he calls himself a white nationalist, but educated white Anglo-Saxons need to have more kids, and David Duke only has two. Now, the guy he was talking to had 10 kids. So that's North Idaho. The final thing I'll mention about North Idaho is the issue of class. Forget about race for a moment. Let's talk about class. That made me experience my class identity in a different way than I would on the East Coast. And class, to my mind, was a huge issue in North Idaho. And it really crystallized in my mind one particular day when, during the late morning, I hung out with Ed, a fellow I had befriended. And it was only 3 weeks into knowing Ed that he disclosed that he was living out of a rented storage unit because he could not afford the pricey homes in that community. That very afternoon, I went to the sprawling estate of third-generation cattle barons, and their guest that afternoon was U.S. Senator Mike Crapo. It was a meet-and-greet for Senator Mike Crapo, and he promised the gathering more tax relief. And so that's a big theme of Whitetopia, is lower taxes. And so class is a big issue. When you say gentrification in this country, people often think that whites are moving to minority communities and gentrifying it. But what this book teaches me is that whites can move to white communities and gentrify those. And I heard many poignant comments in communities like St. George, Utah, or Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, where working class whites would say, now I can't afford to buy property and raise my kids in the community I grew up in because of the influx of money, often from California, but not always. And so class is a big divide if you scratch under the surface. Of course, people like to pretend it's not an issue, but class is a huge issue in Whitetopia. And forget about the fact that I could play golf with these folks and, you know, feel like they're peers. That's a whole other story. So that's Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. My final Whitetopian visit, or extended visit, was Forsyth County, Georgia, which is an hour north of Atlanta. It qualifies as an exurb. And in case you're not familiar with the term exurb, is just imagine a circle. The circle represents the city. The outer circle represents the inner suburbs, or the suburbs closest to the city. Then you have established suburbs, and then you take the ring one step further out, and then you have the exurbs. So the exurbs are like the suburbs of the suburbs. So in that sense, Forsyth County, Georgia, is an exurb of Atlanta. And Atlanta's teeming with black people. It's teeming with upper-middle-class black people. Atlanta has one of the highest percentage of college-educated black people. And still, you have segregation in the metropolitan Atlanta area. So I spent a lot of time in Atlanta. And the theme of Atlanta, to my mind, was religion. I rented a home in a middle-class gated community, again, more socializing. But what I realized is because I'm not a homeowner and because I do not belong to a homeowner's own association, I missed out on a lot of the bowling nights and the dances and all that. So the only way I felt that I could acclimate and meet people was to join a megachurch. So I joined a megachurch, a huge sprawling megachurch in exurban Atlanta. And it's so huge that the day I rolled up in the parking lot, a guy rolled up next to me in a golf cart and said, do you want to ride to the chapel? So you have to take a golf cart to get to the chapel in this megachurch in Forsyth County, Georgia. And what religious-minded people are arguing, that sometimes church can be the most segregated hour in America, I found that to be true in metropolitan Atlanta. So that was Forsyth County, Georgia. And I'll end with a quick note by talking about golf. Golf, to my mind, is the perfect seductive emblem of Whytopia. And I thought I could not understand Whytopia without learning to play golf. And that was a surprise. I didn't expect how much I would like golf. But and I do. And now that I'm back in New York, I still play. And so, and the reason that is that many Whytopian communities are literally organized around a golf community. In other words, they're golf neighborhoods. So that's the journey. And what I want to add is a lot of this journey is animated by the fact that in or by 2042, whites will no longer be the American majority. Now, a lot of you who are in California are not surprised or particularly bothered by that statistic because it's already here. But California is a distinct minority. There are only four states in this country, California, New Mexico, in Texas and Hawaii, where whites are already the minority. The rest of the country, that can be frightening. And I was literally told again and again over my two-year journey in small communities in South Carolina, small communities in Georgia, small communities even in New Hampshire, that the timber and the texture of these communities are different because of Latino immigration. And so, to my mind, the black-white race divide bores me. When we think of race in this country, we shouldn't think, as we too often do back east, that, oh, black, white. More, it's white, brown, brown, black, white, Asian, American, etc. It's more complicated than that. And there are very few states in this country that already understand that. And then there's Whytopia. So let me, I'd like to, because this is sponsored by the Ethics Council, and just to give you a flavor of some of the writing in the book, I'll read a conclusion that gets to why this matters. So what? So what if we have these Whytopian communities across America? Doesn't matter for people in California or New York or Georgia. What's the net? What's the deal? So beginning to read from the conclusion, and then I'll show a video which also summarizes these issues. A fascinating conundrum dogs Whytopia. Day-to-day interaction in some of the whitest parts of America I discovered is quite pleasant. The majority of whites in these communities across our heartland are endearing and kind. Direct interpersonal racism is no longer acceptable. Still, against this backdrop of improved attitudes in interpersonal interaction, residential segregation is on the upswing. Whites may not move to a place simply because it teems with other white people. Rather, a place's whiteness implies other desirable traits, comfort, cleanliness, perceived safety, and neighborliness. These seemingly race-neutral qualities are subconsciously inseparable from race and class in many whites' minds. Race is often used as a proxy for those neighborhood traits, and if a neighborhood has those traits, many whites presume, without even giving it a thought, that that neighborhood will be majority white. Throughout most of the 20th century, racial segregation was deliberate and intentional. Today, racial segregation and division often result from habits, policies, and institutions that are not explicitly designed to discriminate. Contrary to popular belief, discrimination or segregation do not require animus. They thrive even in the absence of any person's prejudice or ill will. It's common to have racism without racists. Structural racism is baked into our national psyche and behavior. Nationwide, municipal governments enact suburban land use and zoning policies to promote larger lot development, to sustain private property values, to restrict suburban rental housing, all of which limit the influx of working-class white, black, and Latino households. The unabated rise of gated communities, private roads, private parks, private schools, private playgrounds, private, flares for segregation in America and exposes the heart of Whytopia. America's mania for all things private is expensive for each consumer, but that's nothing compared to the stiff price that society will pay in the long term. Rather than wait for private entities to diversify, if or when they please, we must revitalize the public sector. Quote, Our democratic institutions are where we come together to plan for the common good. They are the steward of our environment and future. If these structures are dismantled, disparaged, chronically underfunded, or eroded from within, all citizens are poorer, says Robert Kuttner in his recent book, Obama's Challenge. Also, markets have an unfortunate tendency to put on the auction block things that should be beyond price, such as our democracy and human life itself. We see this as public parks, public schools, public spaces, and even public debate give way to literal or figurative gated communities without concern for the cost to our public commons, ergo the common good. On my long journey through Whitetopia, examples of this private mania surfaced over and over, including how towns and neighborhoods are zoned, how chambers of commerce favor or discourage certain newcomers and certain businesses, how communities block public transportation from reaching their doorstep, and how political and business establishments resolve social conflict, often in the favor of powerful individuals and powerful business interests. Awash in its racial conundrum, America has delightful people who are perfectly comfortable with widening segregation and yawning socioeconomic inequality. The lives chronicled in these pages are not digits in a poll, but real people who share their aspirations and anxieties living in our dramatically changing nation. This book looks into their hearts, their homes, their wallets, and their votes. As a baby boomer's grip on politics wanes, the old categories for thinking, speaking, and acting are becoming vacant of useful meaning. Is it liberal? Is it conservative? Is it black? Is it white? Is it pro-labor? Is it pro-business? Are impotent questions. Neither 60s touchy-feely multiculturalism nor mean-spirited, compassionate conservatism will do the trick. Our conceptual vocabulary and political rhetoric about race, stale from decades past, do not adequately compute the complex algorithms that will make our multiracial nation more like software than like a melting pot. Our racial thinking needs a 21st century upgrade. Identity politics is letting America down on the one hand. Race and structural racism still matter on the other. We must escape this tight spot to thrive. I want America to be a post-racial union. Truly. But we still have massive gaps in public schooling, college access, earnings, savings, home ownership, all the benchmarks of upward mobility, which shake out along racial lines. Public investment over the next decade, including the $800 billion economic recovery, must not further racial inequality and segregation the way that Eisenhower's post-war housing policies and highway programs spawned segregated suburbs for decades to come. Eisenhower was not terribly concerned about the long-term racial impact of his domestic agenda. Obama must avoid that fate. Taxpayers should not again subsidize federal projects that perpetuate segregation and inequity. As America rebuilds its economy and infrastructure, including neighborhoods, roads, bridges, broadband access, if now is not the time to take a fresh look at race and opportunity, then when? This is the moment when we finally need to get it right. So I'll show a video and then conclude.
When those best places to live pop up at you on your web browser, do you ever notice how white they are?
This is footage from the trip, to give you a visual sense.
I decided to embark this 26,000 mile journey because I just had to know one thing. How and where will white Americans live to achieve their American dream?
You go and visit white enclaves all around the country, and you bring statistics to attention that there's been a huge amount of white flight.
And one of the startling things I've come upon, this country is as segregated residentially and educationally as it was in 1970.
Everybody's white, but everybody's, very accepting, and we don't have any problems.
Warren County in general has such low crime. Lots of people don't even lock their doors, even in today's day and age.
As people of color, especially immigrants, live increasingly in suburbs and cities, white people are living in towns and in suburban areas that are predominantly, even extremely white.
You're going to get pressures no matter where you go, but up here you're going to get a lot less.
Is there a contradiction between being white nationalist, Aryan Nation, and ritzy?
There's not a contradiction per se. I mean, ritzy people in that community do not say anything racist, and they're perfectly friendly in that sense.
Back when I first came out, there was mostly one type of person here.
However, Aryan Nations will find a place to feel comfortable among that social and racial homogeneity. The national security narrative merged with the anti-immigration nativist narrative to spark a lot of fear.
By 2042, white people will no longer be the American majority.
Half of the kids in this country under 5 years old are minorities. By far the greatest number are Hispanic. Know what that means? 25 years and the majority population is Hispanic. Do your duty. Make more babies.
What's happening now to white men right now is exactly what was done to black folks. Is exactly what was done to black folks.
No,
but do you understand what the New York Times wants? They want to break down the white Christian male power structure, which you are a part, and so am I. And they want to bring in millions of foreign nationals to basically break down the structure that we have.
Is there a problem in as far as these people in their whitetopias? Do they consider there's a problem? They don't need policing. They've kept the problem outside their doors.
In fact, many people aren't aware of it. They move to these communities with nary a thought of how segregated it is. And implicitly, they just assume the qualities that attracted them, friendliness, comfort, security, are whiteness in and of itself. Many people don't even give it a second thought.
And is the federal government any role to mess with them?
Well, what government does and doesn't do is how it zones. When you zone in a certain way, and it's explicitly told by certain county organizations, is we want the renters out. We want apartment complexes out. And that's code words for immigrants or lower-income whites or blacks.
Given all that we as a nation went through during the civil rights struggle, it is hard for me to accept that the result of those efforts was to create an America that is more prosperous, more positively race-conscious, and yet is voluntarily socially segregated.
The man himself speaking is the new Attorney General of the United States.
Well, I'm really flummoxed. Guy's our age.
Yeah.
We don't look at race.
According to some people, the election of our first black president could make the situation better. Other people say that it might sweep racial issues under the rug. There's a problem for everyone involved when we were segregated by class and by race in such a way. And what I fear is, with the election of Obama, America's shaking out in two versions. One we could call Obama Nation, slap happiness, diversity, yet still residentially segregated, versus Whitetopia.
Okay, and now if you have any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. David's promise.
Professor Edelstein.
Oh, hi. I have two quick comments and then a question that I'm guessing most people in the audience are wondering about. Well, the quick comments are, how many of the people that you interviewed get all their news and information about the world from Fox News? How much of that is the problem? Second, do any of them realize that part of what I grew up in California, and part of what I see happening to the schools is not the impact of immigrants, it's the impact of Proposition 13. So their anti-tax stance and their whitetopian vision certainly go hand in hand. So I wondered what you thought about that. But then the burning question is, how did you present yourself when you moved to some of these communities or attended things like the Aryan Nation compound events? Did you go in as an anthropologist, a journalist? Did you pretend you were just moving to the community because you liked it?
Okay, that's 10 questions. I want to talk about the media.
Yeah.
Without necessarily talking about Fox, and we saw this Bubble Boy incident, and I was distraught by that because here we are looking at this phantom episode, and Obama's in New Orleans explaining the aftermath of New Orleans, and rather than covering Obama, the media is covering the Bubble Boy. And so I think this speaks to the ethics, A, of the person who cheated in his quest for celebrity, but it's also unfortunate, and that's our mentality in this country, is that people of all races are not wanting to look at these issues, and we rather look at Bubble Boy. And shame on the media for short-circuiting the coverage for Bubble Boy. So that's one general comment I'd like to make about the media. And yes, Fox is popular in parts of Whiteopia. And Lou Dobbs is popular. In other words, if you go to a Minuteman meeting or a St. George Citizens Council against illegal immigration, they'll show clips of Lou Dobbs. And they'll cite him and reference him. The second question is how I presented myself. I presented myself as a journalist in these communities, and the only person I deceived were the realtors. In two of the communities, I posed as a home buyer trying to buy a $1 million home, and I didn't tell them who I really was. And the reason I did that was realtors are fascinating. Realtors can tell you the underbelly, nitty-gritty of a community, warts and all, faster than anyone besides a cop. They know what they're talking about. And so to get a sense of these communities, I posed as a home buyer trying to buy a home, and therefore I guess I misrepresented myself. And what was your other questions?
Oh, about the impact of Proposition 13 relative to immigration on what's gone wrong with California schools.
Right. Taxes are fascinating issue in these issues. Because I had spent the time in Whiteopia, and then Obama's inaugurated, and we see these town hall meetings, these tax protests where people say, we don't want our taxes wasted on illegal immigrants. You hear Joe Wilson cry out, you lie, and he doesn't want health care money going to illegal immigrants. So they're tightly intertwined, as you're suggesting, taxes and immigration. And I think that there is an identity crisis in pockets of conservative white America that we see bubble up with the birther movement, with the tax movement, with the immigration movement. And it's tightly wound up in Proposition 13, as you suggest. Now, I try and point out there are all sorts of examples where you have integrated schools in Maplewood, New Jersey, for example, or Richardson County, Texas, for example, that are very integrated and that are top-notch public schools. So the idea that diversity by itself de facto means poor public schools is not true. Okay, next question.
Yes, please.
You specifically went to these very conservative white communities, but you also specifically went to very, very conservative organizations and to Republican meetings as opposed to Democratic meetings. Were there no Democrats there? And if there were, why didn't you go there? And having grown up during the Civil Rights era in New York City, which is very multicultural, when whites were a majority, the issue was to give minorities an opportunity to integrate, which is what they said they wanted. Now, with whites becoming a minority, do they deserve the opportunity to segregate if that's their choice?
Hmm. Okay. I'll take the first question. And did I go to Democratic organizations? And the answer is yes. In St. George, Utah, I went to the Jefferson Jackson dinner for Democrats, and Democrats tend to be the minority in Whiteopias. But her question is well taken. There are Whiteopias that are predominantly Democratic and voted overwhelmingly for Obama. For example, Boulder County, Colorado. There's a Whiteopia neighborhood in my New York City called Carnegie Hill, which I profile. Contributed truckloads of money to Obama, and yet they're a Whiteopia. So it's not just a Republican phenomenon. However, I did do the math, and the vast majority of Whiteopias tipped Republican. But there are Democratic Whiteopias. The second question is, do whites deserve, given the demographic reality, the choice to self-segregate? And that's a complex question. Do they deserve the choice? In the abstract, of course they deserve the choice. The question I have is, to what extent is there choice in all of this? In other words, people say, oh, Latino immigrants, they have this choice of self-segregating, and we tried to integrate them, and they failed, and they never assimilated, and that's their problem. And I don't believe that. I think that in Patchogue, New York, and other counties across America, where immigrants literally feel threatened for not speaking English, and the president of a Latino rights organization called La Raza says that indeed hate crimes against immigrants are on the upswing by upwards of 50%. When you think that immigrants are self-segregating by choice, it's often the case that it's an economic, political, and safety reason why they're in self-selected communities. So I don't believe by choice immigrants, Latino immigrants specifically, are self-segregating. So as a political principle philosophy, sure, anybody deserves the choice to self-segregate. But my question in this book is, to what extent is there choice? In other words, the way we do and don't build public transportation. Forsyth County is a perfect example. Members of that community literally told me, we do not want the Atlanta BART coming up to Forsyth County because it's going to circulate crime. Now, Europeans in Atlanta will say, that's daft. I mean, how do we get to the opera? How do we get to the museums? How do we circulate people who work for us or employees we'd like to work for us without public transportation? But Forsyth County put a firewall, and they're saying, we don't want public transportation coming to our community. So in terms of gated communities, in terms of public transportation or the lack of public transportation, why we build highways as opposed to mass transit, why we zone communities where we tell people, literally, you can only build a private residence on a one-acre lot. Zoning like that, to me, it's not really so much a choice, but it's how these communities are designed and built. But as a philosophical matter, sure. I mean, that's what this country is based on.
Yes, sir.
So I wanted to go back to the issue of presentation, and I wondered, and as well class. I mean, looking at the way you were dressed, the way you wear your hair, the shoes. There is something that sort of screams, you know, educated, hip, coastal.
Oh, and Jesus.
It's a kind of a bohemian thing. And there is, I think, my experience being a bi-coastal elitist, having gone to school at Johns Hopkins in Berkeley, you look like somebody that I recognize. And I wondered what, you know, if you had gone into these communities with your head shaved, no beard, wearing, you know, like a muscle t-shirt that said NRA. And, I mean, how do you, to what degree do you think their reactions to you were driven not just by skin color, but by style?
Oh, boy. I didn't dream I'd come all the way to SCU to be insulted. But the question's fair enough, and he's on to something. When I showed up at America's Promise Ministry, I had a baseball cap, I had cargo shorts, and I had a pickup truck with Idaho plates, and my cell phone number had the proper three-digit prefix of that Idaho community. And by that point, I had been there 2 months, and people had seen me at the gun club. So his point is well taken. I didn't show up like, oh, some smarty-pants Seattle journalist. And I'm sure a lot of smarty-pants Seattle journalists show up to Idaho, oh, look at these backwards people. So I had been well integrated, and I don't appear as I didn't appear as I do today. I'll put it that way. So I guess that's perceptive.
I want to raise, what is your basic thesis, that this is white flight, or this is socioeconomic flight that happens to have racial implications?
I would say it's more of the latter. Socioeconomic flight that has white racial implications.
Follow-up question then. Do you think this is a generational thing, that the next generation with more black middle class and black upper middle class, our children will feel perfectly comfortable doing socioeconomic flight, which I suspect will still be with us, on a multiracial basis? Or do you think this is a persistent thing, that there will remain white enclaves in the next generation?
Yeah. By the way, I want to make a caveat to my last answer, is that just because it's socioeconomic, I don't think it's better. In other words, I don't think that socioeconomic flight is better than racial flight. So I don't want to minimize it by calling it socioeconomic flight, even though I agree with you. And is it generational? Not necessarily. I think we're in the third generation of this. The first generation of white flight was in the 1950s, when Eisenhower built the highways in certain ways and you had restrictive covenants and whatnot. The second wave of white flight was after the urban riots, when Detroit burned and Watts burned and L.A. burned, Newark. And then we saw white flight and black flight in the 1970s, middle-class black flight. And then I think this is the third wave, and there's nothing in my mind that indicates it'll stop by itself, given the historical pattern.
Jim?
I kind of took a peek at your book relative to the Whitetopia cities, counties, extreme, et cetera, and I was struck, although this is just by sight, that there were very few New England communities mentioned. There was only one in all three lists from Maine. There are a couple from New Hampshire, three or four from New Hampshire. There's one from Vermont. Maybe there's one in Connecticut. Rhode Island's a little small. But, you know, is there something about New England that differentiates itself, or is it just a matter of population? It's just an observation.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I don't think there's something characteristically about New England. It's more because this is a book about migration, New England doesn't meet that metric of migration. Most of the migration, as you well know, is in the West, in the Southwest, and the South. Although there are, I'd say, about five New England Whitetopias. And there are many New England communities that are overwhelmingly white, but they're not Whitetopias because they haven't grown quickly enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, sir.
The three examples you gave, St. George, Coeur d'Alene, and well, not so much Atlanta, but I know people who've gone to each of those places. St. George and Coeur d'Alene, they're basically retirement age. Those are not places where you can generally move to and make a living. As you pointed out, they tend to be pushing out the people that were living there, making a living of whatever the economy was before they went. Mm-hmm. You don't really, as cities or counties economically, they wouldn't stand on their own if it wasn't for the retirement income these people bring with them when they move there. And is that what you find across most of the Whitetopias that you went to?
I thought a lot about that. I assumed that St. George, Utah was just a retirement community, but in fact it's not. I mean, you'll see plenty of Little League and kick soccer and kids crammed at the public library at story hour, and it's not. St. George, Utah is teeming with young families. And the same is true of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And people are making livings in biotech, in healthcare, in high-tech telecommuting. And so, but your point is well taken, that if you didn't have these retirees with their money and with their leisure and with their medical needs, they're a huge economic support to these communities. But I couldn't, as much as I wanted to, just dismiss these as retirement communities. They have a lot of young families.
Peter, that was very interesting about the Eisenhower and the highways maybe being conducive to, you know, Whitetopia back then. And what I'm curious is, and I understand about zoning, local laws, maybe even state, Prop 13, are there current federal practices that are conducive to Whitetopia that might be changed? Federal practices. How is the government impacting the federal government?
Well, north of New York City, there's Westchester County, and that's where the Clintons live. That's where Alan Arkin lived. There's a lot of famous, wealthy people in Westchester County. And Westchester County was just sued. And the reason it was sued is because it receives federal money for all sorts of projects, and it agreed to meet some benchmarks in terms of inclusionary zoning and in terms of affordable housing. Not only did it fail to meet those benchmarks, it deceived the government in reporting on those benchmarks. It was found out, a group sued them, and instead of being settled in court, it was settled out of court, and they agreed to take XYZ measures to integrate. And so what that means is that the Justice Department seems to be taking a stricter stance by saying, if you're receiving federal tax dollars as XYZ community to do this and that, then you should meet federal benchmarks. And if you're not receiving federal money for XYZ, then I guess you're going to do what you want. But so the short answer to your question is, it seems to be an enforcement mechanism, how federal policy gets involved.
There are questions. Yes, sir.
As you were reading the conclusion, one of the statements that struck me the most was, you said that there can be racism without racists.
Yeah.
Can you explain that concept more? Because I think that's a fascinating thing to me. So.
Meaning, and this I acknowledge, and I think there are a lot of liberals who make a living pointing out racism or complaining about racism, and then now we have a black president and they won't acknowledge how much race relations have improved because it's against their political, financial, or whatever interests. And I want to acknowledge that. I mean, race relations have drastically improved, and I know firsthand since my parents' generation, period. And we should pat ourselves on the back for that. So that's what I mean by the first part of that statement, that you can have racism without racists. The racism doesn't come in any individual's attitude or personal behavior. The racism comes in how we design communities. And I'll give you a quick example from St. George, Utah. A business owner told me that when she moved to St. George, Utah, the Chamber of Commerce pulled her aside and said, hey, this is our Chamber of Commerce. Why don't you join? And we just want you to know that we're doing all we can to keep immigrants out. And he meant that as a recruitment tool to help her come. And this is all documented. So that's an example of what I'm talking about, where we have racism without racists, is that how do you recruit people? How do you recruit businesses? What is your agenda? What is your method? And it all comes out. Once you spend enough time in these communities, you figure out how it and where it is.
What about age demographics? Is there an unusually large percentage of people over 50? Is there a substantial young population in these communities?
Age demographics mixed. They're mixed. Now, St. George, Utah is probably tipped towards older people. And St. George, by the way, has more golf courses per capita than any town in America. And so some of these are tipped towards older people, but in no community is it exclusively or even majority older people. And Coeur d'Alene is very young. Coeur d'Alene's young. Forsyth County has a lot of young people. As you know, Boulder County has a lot of young people.
What about education levels? Do you know maybe percentage of university degrees?
I didn't look at the percentage of university degrees. I did look at class. Classes, they're generally wealthier than the average American county.
Sir?
I'm curious to hear how you foresee this kind of playing out over time, assuming no radical changes in public policy. Status quo, do we end up... The way I envision it is there's a certain subset that is self-segregating, and the people who don't want to be in those kind of communities are not moving to those communities. So it's kind of a self-reinforcing phenomenon that there'll be some these pockets of utopia that won't necessarily kind of take over America, so to speak, but will just kind of stay as some pockets. They won't disappear, but do you kind of foresee this as a growing phenomenon, or that it's like something that will dwindle over time, or kind of like over time, how do you see this phenomenon unfolding?
It's hard to say. It's hard to, in terms of what the economy does, what the housing market does, what we do temperamentally as a country. But I do see, part of my concern is, I do see ideological divisions hardening in this country, and that does not bode well. In other words, I think that speaks for itself. I think we're as partisan as we've been during the Clinton era or the Bush era, both Bushes, and so I'm not optimistic on that prospect. But the rest, the housing market, the financial market, a lot of this is oil, too. I mean, are we going to want to build eco-friendly, more green communities, never mind communities that are more racially integrated? I mean, what will communities look like generally in this country? So I'd hesitate to say.
Time for one more question. Yes, please.
I wanted to hear a little more about your experience with realtors. You said they gave you a lot of information. Were they aware of that they were showing houses in a Whitetopia? Did they have a sense of it? Did they convey that to you? What was your experience along those lines?
Yeah, they know it's white. But they never explicitly said anything. And realtors are very crafty. They don't want to scare me, nor do they want to scare the community they're selling in. And so I do think that I could have, if I did have the money, I nowhere near have the money to buy a house in these gated communities. But if I did have the money, there's a sense that I could, in fact, buy a house. And that the realtors are crafty, and they have all sorts of code words. They say, they had ways of telling me, Rich, don't buy in this community. It's on a downward spiral, quote unquote, or this or this. And so my interactions with the realtors were some of the most fascinating in how they talk code words about race, how they talk code words about crime, how they talk code words about school districts and safety. And it's fun. I'm sorry. There's a lot of real estate porn in this book. There's a lot of, you know, marble floors, granite, and how that whole... this is about people's homes. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Well, our time is up in this fascinating discussion and presentation. I'd like to thank Rich Benjamin.
Thank you.